my screen. All right, 6:01. Good evening. I'd like to call to order the Kaiser City Council in a work session. It is Monday, October 10th, 2022, and thank you everybody for adapting so quickly to move over to Zoom. And with that, I would like to turn it over to our guest this evening. And who is going to lead off?
I can go ahead and lead off. So this is Ryan Matthews. I'm the administrator for Marion County Health and Human Services. Thank you all for the invitation tonight. I'll be turning it over to our crisis management team to talk about mobile crisis and some of the great programs that they have developed and kind of maybe how that could interact with the city of Kaiser. I guess I just wanted to start by saying that, you know, supporting the public safety needs of our community is one of our highest priorities as a community mental health program. So we take a lot of pride in the investments that we've made in our behavioral health crisis system and some of the innovative programs that we've had. It's always a great opportunity to meet with some of our community partners and community leaders just to build awareness of what exists and figure out if there are better, more effective ways for us to partner with each other. I'm sure each of you will probably have some, you know, your own questions and things that you're hoping to learn from the discussion today. So we're happy to take questions as appropriate. I think I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to our program manager over our acute forensic and crisis services, Anne-Marie Banfield. Anne-Marie, if you want to do an introduction and kind of get the ball rolling.
Good evening. I'm Anne-Marie, and I've been working with Marion County for the last 30 years, and I've been doing crisis work for the last 30 years. we have been very fortunate in Marion County to have visionaries in our leadership who have seen the need for things like a 24/7 crisis center. And as of August of this year, we have been in a fully functioning crisis center, never closed, for the past 27 years, and we are 24/7. And it's something the rest of the state is trying to get to, but something that we've been building for 27 years. And a lot of what we've been able to do is create infrastructure that we can use to expand our crisis services as there is a need. We actually didn't start out with mobile crisis as our primary, our first starting place for a mobile response. We started with the community outreach response team, in which we did not feel like we were quite prepared to be in the cars with the officers. So what we did is collect law enforcement reports from all over the county. And we had a team that would respond to those reports. And what we found is a lot of people that we were serving and working with, a lot of the people that our local law enforcement were having contact with, were persons who were having mental health crises, but not necessarily our traditional severe and persistent mental illness. And so what our team does is a lot of referral. We have a transitional case management team that takes those referrals from that original team making that contact, and we're doing whatever it takes to help alleviate that crisis so that person doesn't have contact with law enforcement. And some examples of that are we've had a few people who couldn't figure out how to redo the paperwork for either their Social Security income, or maybe to get their organ health plan restarted. They didn't understand the phone call system. I don't know if any of you have ever had to go through, navigate one of these systems before. I find my own health insurance difficult to navigate, but some of the public health insurance is fairly difficult to navigate. So one of what our team does is we try and be where people are and help them with the little things that become large things that make it hard for them to manage a situation until it feels like it's out of control. So that team was started in 2010, had a lot of really good interaction. We learned a lot about how to interact and work with law enforcement. And when the opportunity came up in 2013 to apply for mobile crisis dollars, we were one of the first counties that were able to stand up teams. The money came out in October of 2013, and we had two teams stood up by April of 2014, working with, one team was with our Marion County Sheriff's Office, and one team was with Salem PD. We had the opportunity in 2016 to expand those teams. We did talk with the Kaiser Police Department, and I wanna say that I have always found our police department in Kaiser to be very receptive. We've talked a lot, we've helped work on cases. Sometimes it's through civil commitment, sometimes it's through mobile crisis. I've always found them to be good partners. But at that time, they really just didn't have the staffing to be able to partner with us. And so as we worked at worked throughout the county and how to bring on two more teams, we ended up partnering with Salem PD for a second team and with Woodburn. So presently our mobile crisis teams are 7 days a week. They are from 8 a.m. in the morning until midnight. They are, Salem PD has two teams and they work opposite of each other. So there's a Salem team on at all times. And then Marion County Sheriff and Woodburn work opposite of each other. The teams being part of the team means agreeing to respond anywhere in the county. It's a challenging program. One, we have a lot of turnover. The hours are not the ones that people get most excited about. Most people aren't necessarily excited about working evenings or nights. The hours are long. You're 10 hours in a car with a law enforcement officer and a qualified mental health professional. Choosing the right pairing is really crucial. 10 hours in a car together can be forever if you aren't getting along. And so really being able to work hard to make sure it's going to be a good fit. We need officers who are open to letting us do our jobs, do the mental health evaluation, really work with that person to figure out how we can help them work through the crisis. And we need qualified mental health professionals who are able to work well with a law enforcement officer. This isn't necessarily a job for an advocate. We don't need somebody in the car who's going to tell the police all the things they're doing wrong. That's not a good partnership. Likewise, we don't need an officer who's going to not let our staff do their job. We've had some hits or misses along the way. We've had folks that just weren't a good pairing for the team. And we've had some really good work done. One of the very first encounters we had a gentleman out off of Gordon Road. He was a veteran who was having a full flashback, thought he was in Fallujah after a car accident. And they brought in our team and they were able to help him. It took some time. It took a half an hour, 45 minutes to talk him out of the bushes and to come out and safely engage with us. And we were able to take him to the hospital without anyone being hurt. They didn't have to use any kind of, they have many tools in their arsenal of law enforcement to help engage people and bring people out into the community when they need to subdue them. And they didn't have to use any of those. More recently, we had a situation in one of our apartments where several consumers for Marion County have lived us in supported housing. And we had somebody who was having a full on psychotic break and they were not having a good day. And they woke up and threatened their roommate. Everybody was able to exit the house safely. Law enforcement was called. As Chief T can tell you, there's a lot of restrictions on what law enforcement can do in a situation when somebody is dangerous, but not at imminent risk to anyone else. And so partnering with us, partnering with the team that serves this person, we were able to stay on that situation all day, check in, make sure we were keeping everybody in the apartment complex safe. And when the point came where they did need to engage this person, they were able to do so, even though they did have to pull out their guns and they did have to surround him. No one got hurt. They were able to bring him out, calm him down, get him to engage with them so that they could safely take him into custody. And we've been extremely fortunate to partner with our local law enforcement to do crisis intervention training. We've also been building really good partnerships with our local law enforcement for the last, 8 years doing mobile crisis and working with them, doing trainings that has allowed us to really build that partnership so that we can be good consultants. We know when to step back and let them do their jobs. They know when to call us and say, hey, what can we do with this case? And we've really seen that partnership really grow. I'm going to ask I want to introduce Debbie Wells. She's our program supervisor, and her job is to let me be free to make new programs and manage what's going on in the office. And Ann Ocelia is our clinical supervisor for our law enforcement collaboration teams. And you've been in the car. Would you like to talk a little bit about that collaboration?
Yeah, I spent 4 years as a QMHP part of the mobile crisis team. And a lot like Anne-Marie said, it is it is kind of a two-part job. One is doing the QHP part and helping the community in the best we can. And two is partnering with community services all around. And we would go to different law enforcement agencies and try to connect with teams there, patrol officers there, so they knew that we were there and available when we can.
And, hey, Anne, just real quick, can you define QHP for me, please?
Sure. QMHP, it's quality, qualified mental health professional.
Thank you.
A graduate level therapists, or I mean, we have either social works or license or counseling degrees usually.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. I forgot kind of where I was going, but either way, it's very beneficial, and we're able to go to reach a lot of people out there in the community, and able to kind of relieve some of the patrol officers to be able to go do more of the criminal aspects. And we can spend a little bit more time helping a family or a client or an individual with kind of de-escalating their crisis, figuring out what's going on and what's the best plan for helping the situation right now, whether it's referring to other programs, whether it's stabilizing in place, making a safe plan for where they are right now, or sometimes we have to go to the hospital early or without a choice. And the least case scenario is we go to jail, but that usually never happens. I mean, we do a pretty good job with that.
Actually, I have some stats I can share with you. What we know is over 50% of the people we see, they're able to stabilize in their own home, de-escalate the situation, refer them on to resources in our community or back to a provider that they may be working with or to our crisis center to receive those services. And about 30% go to the crisis center. We know that less than 4% are going to the jail. And of that very small percentage, 98% of those are going because there's a warrant in place that cannot be ignored. So the point of these teams is not to create more avenues into the criminal justice system. The point of these teams is to direct people out of the criminal justice system and into the services they need. So it could be working with Arches downtown. We could be working with our transitional services in our office. We could be working with an agency that they're already connected to. Are there any other questions? I mean, we could go on all night. We're trying to keep it brief so that we give you a picture of what we do, but we give you a chance to ask us questions.
Councilor Herrera.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. You know, basically, I know a little bit about this, but basically it's to reduce, and tell me if I'm wrong, to reduce the contact with police with the mentally ill and keep them out of incarceration, basically. So that's the final goal. Is that correct?
That is a large part of what we're trying to do is really one of the things that we've always done every time we're about to create a new program is try and meet with the people who are we're going to be engaging with and really talk with them about what they need. And one of the things we know, there's some very loud voices that come out of the Tri-County urban area and to the north of us, but they don't always express the experience of everyone. And we've had really good feedback from the peers in our community that these programs have really helped them to build some trust in our local law enforcement and to feel less afraid when law enforcement comes because they've had good experience and access to our mobile crisis teams. And we know working with Salem PD, they've been very gracious because when I asked for data, they've found new ways to collect data so that I can have it. And we know last year they had 26,000 emotionally disturbed person calls. So I know, and Ryan knows this too, we could triple the numbers of teams that we have and still not get to everybody who needs us. And so that's a large part of what we do is absolutely right. We're trying to really help people that ended up in the criminal justice system because of the numerous changes that happened around institutions. And those of us that have been here for a long time, those institutions, you know, they opened up the institutions, but they didn't make a great pathway into community services. So we're here to try and help them get back into those services and really address those needs as best we can.
Thank you. By the way, I've done crisis work my whole life. My family.
Let me know if you want a job. I'm short-staffed.
I have got a couple other people with questions. I'm going to go to Councillor Starr and then to Chief T.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, thank you. Two questions. What is the difference between Marion County's mobile crisis unit model and the CAHOOTS model out of Eugene? That's question number one. And then my second question is, so to put a mobile unit in Kaiser, what would the needed investment be?
So how are we different from CAHOOTS? That's a great question. I've been answering it a lot lately for like the last 4 years. And what I would tell you is CAHOOTS is a medical model. So they have an EMT as well as a qualified mental health professional. And Eugene, of course, has its own unique system. And one of the things that's different is CAHOOTS only serves Eugene and Springfield. We serve all of Marion County. Commissioner Cameron loves to tell the story about being in a police car and having our qualified mental health professional staff show up in Aurora. And there's been pictures of us in Woodburn and out in Silverton. So one of the chief differences is that we serve our entire county. And that would be one of the things to think about with an investment is coming onto the team, we would ask you to be ready to respond to the whole county. The other piece is that because we're in the cars with law enforcement, we have a lot more opportunity to evaluate the calls that are going out and knowing what's safe. In Eugene, there's several layers of calls that come out. They have several opportunities. They have a detox center in Eugene. They have a hospital. So by the time you get down to the layers and CAHOOTS, we went to their respite location and Debbie and I were shocked because it's all open and they have this beautiful waterfall that comes down glass. We're looking at each other going, they have glass. Do people not throw those rocks around here? Because in my office, they do. And so it's a different environment in terms of the number of options that they have in Eugene before looking outside of that higher level. By being in the police cars and responding to those 911 calls, those are happening kind of in the moment. We are very quickly dispatched, talking with Eugene Police and with CAHOOTS. I think the last statistic I heard is about 25 to 30% of their calls, they actually have to call 911 in on because something changes in that moment and it becomes a less safe situation. And so they still have to call 911 to come in and help them with those situations. Where we're already working with 911, we're already in that moment of that 911 call when we go out and see people.
Thank you. I'll bet you're getting that question a lot because I'm hearing a lot of it from one particular counselor in Salem. And then there's some more discussion statewide. Just for the record, I'm the chair of the Mid-Willamette Valley Homeless Alliance. And we work very closely, Marion County, Polk County, City of Salem, City of Kaiser. I'm working to address the needs of people experiencing homelessness and this issue about people in mental health crises has been very significant and very important to ensure that we have the proper response and level of response to get people where they need to be rather than making things not getting towards solutions, which is what sounds like this has been about and will continue to be about. Chief?
Yeah, my very first call for service at Kaiser PD was responding to a mom over in Southeast Kaiser who was concerned. She felt threatened by her son. And we made the 28-year-old, little experienced in law enforcement, non-professional judgment to take her son into handcuffs and take him over to State Street and do a civil commit. It just happened just like that. And those things today, those circumstances today just simply don't happen. We have professionals that make these decisions, whether to hold somebody or not, whether we do a POC, a police officer custody, and take a person to a Salem hospital where then a crisis counselor comes in and makes an evaluation and decides to keep or not, or even better is when the crisis counselor comes to us. And that's what Marion County Crisis, Mobile Crisis provides for us. So we know that when somebody's in crisis and they call a cop, or they call for help and a cop shows up, it's probably not the best thing in the world for them to be put in handcuffs for any reason and taken somewhere. But too often, that's what has to happen if Mobile Crisis doesn't show up. So it's better for everybody if they do. We are delighted at Marion County Mobile Crisis. I want to answer Shaney's second question, or Counselor Starr's second question for Anne-Marie. And that is, Anne-Marie, you would acquire an FTE, is that right?
Yeah. It's a commitment of an officer, and we have had other jurisdictions talking about maybe having us work with an officer maybe one day a week instead of a full-time officer, depending on their availability with the jurisdiction. But part of the mobile, and it's a very small community, but part of the participating with Mobile Crisis is one, committing to a full FTE to partner with us, also to commit to being at our briefings. We have a briefing once a week where we are reviewing many things. We're reviewing cases, but we're also reviewing, we really just talked this week about reviewing safety protocols. We are going to be expanding our crisis services that I'm sure you've all read about, the expansion of the mobile response stabilization services that is coming out from the state. That's going to look different than mobile crisis. That's actually going to be some community response teams. That's a qualified mental health professional and a mentor. And there's going to be some family support mentors, and there's going to be some certified recovery mentors. I'm sure this is not a shock to any of you, but our co-occurring response for crisis right now is about 90% co-occurring for drugs and alcohol, as well as mental illness. And so we're going to be addressing that by having certified recovery mentors joining us. So we're going to have some other teams that will be partnering with our law enforcement teams as well to respond out in the community. But being a part of the team does mean an FTE. And a car, please.
Ah, a car.
That's an important ad.
Yes, it is. It's a very important ad.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions?
Yes, I can answer the question about the LEAD program. Thank you for asking that. LEAD is a response with law enforcement around alcohol and drugs. And so it's really a diversion away from some kind of criminal justice or some kind of charges around alcohol and drugs. And so I don't know if you're aware or not, but we have bought a building and we're going to be moving our crisis center to Commercial Street. We're going to almost triple the amount of space we have because we have woefully outgrown the space that we have, although Salem Hospital has been a wonderful host for the last 27 years. But in that new program, in that new building, we will have room for LEAD. They will co-locate with us so that we can work together and share the services that we have. There are a lot of ways that we can overlap with LEAD. I think one of the struggles that everyone in the state has is there are very specific restrictions on information that's shared between the drug and alcohol world and the mental health world. We've been really looking hard at ways we can break down those silos so that we can serve these folks well. One of the things I'm looking forward to through the new Burn Grant is having a CADC2, a certified drug and alcohol counselor, two in our building that will address crisis in the moment with us throughout the day, as well as a clinical supervisor for, I think that will make two or three people in our offices that are certified, are CADCs. Is that right, Debbie? Am I right on that? So we're constantly looking for ways to meet the need as it comes in and to have that availability in the moment for what people need.
So talk to me a little bit about this siloing or these barriers between drug and alcohol and mental health, because again, this significantly impacts the ability to meet the needs, especially among our chronically homeless who often span both of these scenarios. Where do these silos come from, and are there things that we can help promote or partner with to see where we can help do this better?
I'll start, and then Ryan can take over if he needs to. The siloing starts at the federal level. It starts with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. There are very specific billing codes, and we are all, no matter how, I mean, we all wish that we could have, you know, just do our work and just get paid to do our work so we could do it. But the reality is we have to have funding streams. We have to be able to bill for the services that we provide. And you have to have the right letters behind your name in order to bill certain codes. And so the codes and funding for substance use or substance issues and the codes that we use for mental health are very distinct and separate. You have to have separate schooling, separate certification to be able to bill those codes. So it starts at the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. I think OHA recently has been asking for some variances, which I think we just got one. I didn't have a chance to look at it. But here we've just got some changes that is allowing us to bundle some of our crisis services for coding so that we can bill more effectively for the work that we're doing. But it starts there. There's also, it also has to do with HIPAA, and HIPAA, of course, being the protected information and what can be shared with whom. And we actually don't have access to a lot as qualified mental health professionals to a lot of the drug and alcohol information. And Ryan, I will let you fill out that information in a much more cool way.
Well, I think you captured it pretty well. I mean, I think definitely what we've seen over the years is that through the coordinated care organization, so for Marion County, Marion and Polk, at that specific source, they tend to be a little bit more flexible with the funding because they look at it as how they serve a member, and they're the funding's a little bit less siloed. I think definitely when you're talking about direct contracts with the state, it's very specific if it is a mental health service or if it is a substance use service. There are different program elements, they have different requirements. Certainly it can be, it's different staffing and different credentialing required to provide those services. And as Anne-Marie mentioned, there are different HIPAA rules, 42 CFR for substance use treatment. It has higher confidentiality standards. So in terms of coordination of care and sharing of information, it becomes a little bit more challenging. But I think the Measure 110 is a perfect example of this, actually. So you've probably heard a lot of what came out of Measure 110, which was increased funding for substance use treatment. Well, when we applied for a proposal with the state of Oregon about how we wanted to utilize those funds, we really initially tried to build in a lot for co-occurring because we serve people who have that kind of fall into both buckets. They have mental health challenges and they also need substance use treatment as well. We were basically told we can't include any of the mental health services as a component of the treatment in that grant proposal because Measure 110 funding is specifically for substance use only. So at that state level, they're sort of putting in these restrictions based on kind of the nature of the funding that they're trying to use and what it's intended for. And it can become really problematic when you're trying to build programs and treat individuals in our community that are more complex than, you know, a single label or a single bucket of funding can kind of point towards. So there are barriers that I don't know other than advocacy at our level. We can't do a lot to overcome because they're kind of written into contracts or written into like federal statutes and things of that nature. But I think it's, over time, it's slowly getting better, but it's nowhere near where it ultimately needs to be. So it's slow, very, very slow and steady progress.
Very frustrating, though, because as you know, frontline, the people that you're trying to serve at a very high percentage have both those things going on. And to say, I mean, it's like any of us going in for some sort of medical procedure. Well, this person can take care of the right toe and this person can take care of the left toe. It's as frustrating as heck.
It is.
And we aren't allowed to integrate as fully as we need to for the whole person to get to solutions and services that would more comprehensively serve that individual. So this just frustrates the cookies out of me, but it tells me where to lean in because unpaid, what are they going to do, fire me?
Yeah, there really is that challenge. And I think the other challenge that still exists in the behavioral health field really is with pre-engagement is basically what we say when somebody who has not yet consented to treatment. So for us to bill, we need somebody to consent to treatment and we need to be able to do an assessment, develop a treatment plan, and then provide services and bill. Well, many of the people that we come across, especially when you're talking about, you know, our unsheltered population, they're not going to consent to treatment, at least not to begin with. Like most of the time, we're going to have a lot of interactions. And this is really kind of what was created. This is one of the reasons the LEAD program was created, is because we knew we needed ways to build relationships with these individuals and build trust and build pathways into services. We don't get paid really for that. I mean, that is work that we have to do that we can't bill for. We can't bill for it until they're actually enrolled in services. But so much of the work is just building that trust and those relationships to guide people through the system to get them into the right place where they can be served. You know, these are just areas that I think the healthcare system, at least on the behavioral health side, just has not quite yet evolved into where it needs to be. We need to have a little bit more flexible funding to be able to be creative in how we support individuals, because that's really the only way to get at the problem. The problem is more complex than what I think the system is kind of created to support.
Actually, Ryan, I would also say what is unique about us in the crisis and acute care side of the services in our county is that our primary goal is engagement. If somebody comes into the crisis center, they're going to be hosted. They're going to be offered. We have water, juice, coffee, tea. Don't tell anybody, but we only serve decaf. We have goldfish crackers, which apparently are extremely popular with people out on the street. We have string cheese. We have fruit during the holiday months, November, December. We have cookies and hot chocolate so that people can also feel like they're entitled to enjoy the holiday season. In the summer, nobody leaves our building without a popsicle and a bottle of water. And in the winter, they get something hot to drink and a cup of soup. I know it's not particularly nutritious, but it's hot and it's going to get them through that night. So a lot of what we do is engagement, and we're trying to, there's not a lot of mandated services that we can use to get people into service. All we can do is just keep coming up with carrots. What can we do for you? What can we offer you? How can we make you feel welcomed in our space so that you want to be here?
That was fabulously helpful information. There's a from Shani in the chat, because co-occurring disorder often occurs in people self-medicating their mental health issues, do you have data of the calls you have responded to that includes both substance abuse and mental health?
As I touched on earlier, we know that the data we've looked at is between 87% and like 92%. So we know we're up over 90% co-occurring walking in our office. Some is self-medicating simply because the medications that we have available don't touch the illnesses that they are dealing with. One of the things, you know, schizophrenia, we know, initially what I heard is about 20% of the population that experience schizophrenia will not get relief from medication. But more recently, I heard it's as high as 30% of the people who we're giving medication to aren't actually getting relief from that medication. So they're going to turn to other options. The other thing to think about as well is that a lot of, when we talk about mental illness, we're trained to think of mental illness as severe and persistent mental illness. So we're talking about schizophrenia, severe, you know, the depression, the ongoing serious depression, the bipolar disorder. Those are the things that we think of. But the reality is we see so much trauma. Almost everybody has been touched by trauma. If you try and navigate the systems in this community or the county or the state, it is difficult and it is frustrating, and it creates its own systems trauma that people have to go through. And so when we talk about self-medicating, people are thinking of these really big names like schizophrenia. And the reality is what we see are people are self-medicating the trauma they've experienced. This is how they've learned to manage those traumas and those trauma reactions. I think the other thing that people don't talk about is every time somebody uses methamphetamine, they are playing Russian roulette with schizophrenia for the rest of their life, and not the kind that we can medicate well.
Can I
about that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I just clarify? You said, I think it was that come to your office are co-occurring, but I was curious about the calls that you were responding to.
Yeah, it's those are that's looking at our entire population that we serve. So we haven't separated it out into smaller groups, but it's still, the numbers are not very different between each one of the programs that we have. It's a very high co-occurring rate.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. There's a question from Ms. Johnson. Did you want to, Shannon?
Yeah, thank you. I was not clear on the members of the team as a police officer sure. and a qualified mental health professional. Was that correct?
That is correct. And I may have confused you because I mentioned how we are expanding into a different kind of a team. But yes, the mobile crisis with law enforcement is a QMHP, a qualified mental health professional, and a law enforcement officer in the car. And there would be some expectations for the chief or a lieutenant to participate in our leadership team as we look at and try and problem solve monthly kind of the issues that come up across the, it's, and I'm sure Chief T can agree with me, when you're managing, if Kaiser were to join us, I'm sure that would bring up a fourth, a fourth union that we would be negotiating within this team. There's a lot of things that have to be worked out when you're bringing multiple agencies into a program and into a team.
So true. Other questions or comments or thoughts? Don't wait to be called on because I might not be able to see you.
Debbie, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that you've touched on pretty much all the most important things that we want to get out there. Like you said, our main thing is engagement, and we just want to meet these people where they are so they don't have to be taken somewhere else to be served. So
I do have one tangential question. My head's spinning with what you're telling me here because it's fitting in so I think that's a really good question. Actually, Mr. Brown, if you want to ask that question, because I'm thinking about the interface that we have on the Homeless Alliance. This significantly impacts almost all of our chronically homeless fall into this the category of people with co-occurring significant issues of abuse. All the different traumas, both mental, physical, emotional, across the board, and how we can better address that. I think that's where some of this conversation around CAHOOTS and some other models, how can we ramp this up? So getting the word out that we have significant programs, and I'm very happy to hear that LEAD will be moving with you because we've been so blessed to have Josh and then now Hank Krapser is on our board for the Homeless Alliance, and they've been fantastic partners in our work. But I'm going to go to, I saw a question from Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Yeah, the question was that is there funding out there for the city to apply to provide an officer to match your program? That you're aware of, that maybe that's something we need to investigate on our side too.
That's a really good question. What I do know is that the state has pretty much told us the funding that we presently get for our mobile crisis team specifically is probably not going to increase because they're looking to have one of the things that we'll be doing over the next 2 years. And I say 2 years because right now, as you are all aware, trying to find staff is a real difficulty. But over the next 2 years, we're going to be really looking at all of our services and really expanding how the whole all of that we do from the very front end crisis work through that engagement piece through short term stabilization and connection to other agencies. And a lot of the money that the state is sending to us is for creating a youth and family services that mirror the adult services we already have in place. So that's going to be a lot of our expansion over the next 2 years. So I think it's a really good question to ask the programs. I think the one off the top of my head that I think about is the Impacts program. I can't remember who promotes that. Ryan, do you remember? I know it comes out of...
I don't remember.
I know that the Sheriff's Office, Jeff Wood, has looked into that. And that would be one of the places where we could potentially look for a grant to add on another team. But I think it would also be worth looking at the Bureau of Justice Administration to see if they have any grants coming out, as well as SAMHSA to see if they have any grants coming out.
Chief?
Yeah, I check the NIJA and the BJA weekly for all grants, and I don't find anything of this nature, but much like the school district pays for two of our FTEs and a quarter of our of a supervisor with funding that they provide, that we might look to Marion County Health to back fund this reimbursement. So maybe we can come alongside you to apply for a mental health grant. You know, you follow me? That might be an even more opportune way for us to go after monies.
I mean, we're all, you know, if opportunities are out there, we're always open to that. I do think in terms of the healthcare field, I think they're trying to gear funding more at this time through like non-law enforcement response of things. So it might make this sort of application more challenging to find a funder to cover that, because I think they're sort of pushing, I mean, slightly away from the law enforcement response, even though as a Marion County, that's a huge value system for us. And we've had great partnerships and we really believe this is, you know, the best way for us to respond. I think in the healthcare realm with some of our payers like Oregon Health Authority and others, I think they're sort of shifting away from that as a priority and looking for different kind of response. So makes me think we might not be super effective in securing funding in that way, but certainly if opportunities are out there and we see them, you know, we'd be open to that for sure.
And this is something that, Chief, if you could get me some talking points for our legislators, especially if they get another opportunity to be of assistance with getting funding specifically to address these needs, which also interfaces with our homelessness crisis, that might be an opportunity. So I'd like to follow up on that. There was a question in the chat on opening a detox center. And I believe that is, we already have some that are already either open or coming online. And I don't think it's only Marion County. I think this is some partnerships across our area.
Ryan, you wanna?
Well, I know that, well, for so detox, I guess it depends what we're, how we're kind of defining this. So Bridgeway Recovery Services does operate a detox facility. So they do have that. That's something that they've had for many, many years, including some medical components to their detox program as well. If you're kind of linking that more towards like a sobering center type of thing that sort of Anne-Marie had kind of talked about that they have kind of in Eugene around the Coots model, I do know there's been some work with Arches around that. To my knowledge, that's really not moved forward. I don't think they've found a provider for a sobering center, and it doesn't feel as though there's a lot of momentum related to that right now. So I don't know if or when, you know, it doesn't look super likely that we'll have one in our community anytime soon. Certainly that's always been something that we've been interested in and how we could collaborate, because I think there could certainly be, would certainly be a valuable resource for our crisis program. But I think finding a provider willing to take on the risk and provide that service has always been a bit of a barrier in where the funding would come from and kind of who would step up to be that provider. So I don't know that that's going to happen anytime soon.
Asking if it's an important resource. Yes, it would be an important resource for us to be able to have.
And the incoming mayor of Salem, Chris Hoy, is the vice chair of the Homeless Alliance as well. And there have been conversations about how to move that forward, because it is recognized as not only a need for people in mental health crisis, but also, again, that housing and homelessness interface as well. So that conversation is progressing, as I understand it, but I can't speak for the two key players there. They're going to have to update us. Also, recently I was at an event at Simanka Place, and they're opening up a room that is it's a detox. It is I don't remember what they called it, but it's medical supervision. When somebody comes in and they need to come down, come off, whatever they are on when they walk in, there's medically supervised space available at that moment. It's in Smolka House. They already have that at UGM, Unity Gospel Mission. In the new facility, they bake those in as well. So those are a couple of examples where there are some beds, just not enough in this community. But the number of beds serving a population needing those services is expanding for the very reason you said. This is a very, very important tool to save lives.
I think there's also some discussion at the legislature this coming session around any kind of mandated treatment for drug-induced psychosis. It's very difficult to do. When we talk about detox, when we talk about folks who need a sobering station, that's very different than somebody who might need detox from a drug-induced psychosis. And that's something you'll find in our emergency room every day, every night. They've got several people that they're trying to address a drug-induced psychosis.
And so that's, if that does come across as a legislative concept, if you would get that to us so we can be aware of that conversation, then we can be informed. And that's where we can go into action, where you as an employee can't. We're electeds. That's what we do. So give us the tools to have those conversations with our legislators, if you would please. And I was glad that was your dog and not mine, because she was right here. And I was just like, oh gosh, there she goes again.
She's 10 pounds, but she thinks she's 50.
Yeah. Yeah, mine does too. She thinks she's the bravest thing on the planet, or the one that needs the attention at all times. Any other questions that are coming? We got about 10 more minutes. If you want, Councilor Herrera.
You know, I'm just curious about the language barrier. Is there any, do you folks have like bilingual for people that could, if you come across that situation? Because, you know, I just kind of wonder about language, talk about barriers, and that's always been a barrier for some. Just curious.
Good question.
Debbie, I'm going to hand this one off to you.
We do have bilingual therapists. We don't currently have any on our mobile crisis teams, but we do have them at PCC. It is a consistent barrier. It's very difficult to recruit for bilingual therapists. We do struggle with that immensely, but we do have a number of positions that are dedicated to bilingual therapists that we work really hard to work with our folks. We also we use our interpreter services very often. We use LanguageLink. So we can always provide the service. We just may not have a therapist in the moment that can provide that service directly, but we will always have an avenue through which we can communicate with the folks that we're serving in their native language.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
It's always in the mental health world, you'll see some misunderstanding that could be array. You probably know that, but
it definitely is, and people have different meanings for different things and different dialects, and you think you're understanding what somebody's saying, and then you realize very quickly that you do not understand what they are saying. So we work very hard to be bilingual, bicultural, and be able to provide that service. We don't always meet the mark, but we work very hard to do so.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. We've been stealing people from college. We're like, come do your internship with us, and then you can just stay.
Well, that just led into my next question, actually, which was about education and the opportunity to maybe help folks who are going into mental health, addiction, substance abuse treatment, these sorts of disciplines. Are there opportunities for either student loan forgiveness or tuition reimbursement and so forth? Are there incentives to bring more people into or make it easier for people to go into these fields? Because this is a problem everywhere. You talk about mental health of any kind, and I'm hearing across the board, staffing is extremely difficult.
We do have some opportunities for student loan forgiveness as working for us as a public entity. We also have been given recently the encouragement to talk with folks about tuition, what we might be able to do for some tuition. And we also provide licensure supervision for folks so that they can get their license while they're working for us. And it's for people, that's a big deal for folks, especially if they eventually want to open up their own practice. So we are constantly looking for new avenues and ways to entice people to come and work for us. Just recently, and I really want to thank Ryan for this. He helped push through a differential for folks on the mobile crisis teams. It is not an easy job. You are wearing a bulletproof vest and you have pepper spray and you have to think about your safety. The officers do a wonderful job of keeping our staff safe, but you are on the front lines and they have seen things that they don't want to talk about. And so he got a differential to really entice for our staff the ability to find staff who'd be willing to come and do this work.
I think some of the other challenges, I mean, there's definitely a lot of incentives out there to try to get people into the field. The hard part is, you know, you have to have so many hours of supervised experience before you can qualify for a QMHP, for example. I believe it's like 4,000 hours. So it just takes time. So I think it's one of those that it's going to take a couple of years before enough capacity kind of gets built into the system, because there's been so much of an investment from the state and federal levels in terms of all these new programs, great ideas, lots of new money. It's created a lot of opportunity, but it's also meant that we're stretching our workforce and there's just simply not enough people that are qualified to do the work that everybody's trying to hire for. So my guess is we're probably 2 to 3 years out before you kind of have maybe a big enough wave where it kind of, you know, fills up all these vacant positions and the behavioral health workforce goes back to feeling like they have enough qualified people to be able to hire, to be able to grow some of the programs where we want to grow. So it's a challenge. It's something that it's nationwide. It's not just Oregon. And I think we're all kind of trying to do our best to support our workforce to get the work done while we can right now, with the hope that there's some reinforcements coming in the near future.
And I'll be honest, I have to wait until all those nice day jobs are filled before people are willing to really look at the hours that we serve. I mean, when you're doing 24/7, not a lot of people wanting to work in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I'm the wife of a fire service veteran of 42 years. I get that. I'm going to take a slightly different turn for these last few minutes. Over the weekend, I had the opportunity to meet with a junior from McNary High School who is very interested in bringing a program that teaches people in the community and especially teens on how to be, and this is my term, not his, it's almost like mental health, mental crisis, CPR, the Band-Aid, that first contact, what to do when somebody's having a crisis, to help inform people, just like CPR saves lives because you know that first thing to do to keep them alive until the professionals get there, to train teens. He's interested in a teen program, but this program also teaches adults how to be that first responder for a mental health crisis. And my husband came with me because as a first responder for over 40 years, I wanted him to hear this program so, you know, he could give me the benefit of his experience. I was very interested in what that would look like. And this program is used in other states. So if I could get your, if you would email me after this, I would love to connect you to have that conversation. And in the work that you do, having more people in the community, just like CPR saves lives, would this be the kind of program to help our community do a better job at that first contact, at that first event, similar to CPR does for that heart attack? Thoughts?
You want to go, Ryan?
Yes. So you'll probably have more details than I'll have about this, but I mean, mental health first aid is a program. It is a training curriculum that is out there. And I think that it does add a lot of value in terms of more people in our community that are trained to deal with encounters that they come across, I think, and recognize certain behaviors in people and figure out how to get them on the right path to services they need is a good thing. I'm not an expert in the mental health first aid training. So I don't know if Anne-Marie or Debbie would probably have more details there. I think in terms of, you know, we have similar, you know, wishes and hopes on suicide prevention. You know, when I think about trying to get more and more people QPR trained so that they're able to, again, recognize risks of suicide and behaviors and how to deal with that encounter. I mean, it's very kind of similar thing. It's like the more of us that are kind of equipped with kind of basic level trainings in a lot of these really, really important areas that we all come across. I mean, there's always situations that we encounter. I think that the better off as a community we are into supporting people and getting them on the right path to treatment. But I don't know, Anne-Marie, if you've got kind of more specifics on the mental health first aid component.
Well, what I would say is if you're not familiar, QPR stands for question, persuade, and refer. And it's something that we put all of our frontline staff, especially our bachelor's level folks, through so that they understand. For us, when we're talking with folks, when they come in our door and they mention the word suicide, for us, that's an invitation to have a conversation. And we are being invited into their world and what's going on with them. But for many people, they get very overwhelmed by that and they don't know what to do with it. And so we have a prevention program that does a wonderful job with QPR. And they really are invested in getting QPR out to all avenues, whether it be schools, whether it be churches, whether it be community and agencies. They really want to help people to not be afraid of that word and not be afraid to engage with people around that. So many people, when I will be honest with you, I've been doing crisis work for almost 30 years, and I'm always shocked when a mental health professional sends me somebody who is suicidal, and I'm like, this is your client. You know them far better than we do. You know, is there a reason why you're not having this conversation with them? But it is a very scary word, and it's very scary to people to respond. And I think we're seeing a lot of investment in the community to really take that fear away and encourage people to engage in that conversation so that people feel, instead of feeling rejected, feel cared for, feel like they're important and that they're seen. And so I think any opportunity we have to connect with our community members that are invested in doing that type of engagement, especially with a part of our community that's hard to engage, such as teenagers, I think that's wonderful. And so I would be delighted to connect with you. And I probably would bring in our prevention team as well, because they do such an amazing job with QPR and getting it out into the communities. The Mental Health First Aid is a wonderful class. We've included it over the years in our crisis intervention training for law enforcement. And it's a very similar premise, just sort of what are the symptoms to look for and what are the first things to do in engaging people? And usually it's a one-day class. So it's also just a wonderful, we have staff who are trained and certified to do that, to provide that training. And so for us, the balance is training versus actually getting out in the field and seeing people and engaging the people that need us. So it's a hard balance, because you start doing the training and it's like, oh, it's important for these people to have this training. It is important, but your job is to go out and see people. So we really, you know, trying to help our staff find the balance between doing trainings for the community and getting out there and engaging the people who are in crisis is a hard balance sometimes.
Well, and it's like CPR training, the more of us in the community and maybe some trainers, you know, train the trainers sorts of things would expand the number of people who have this ability and know what those first steps are, so it doesn't become worse and makes your job easier as well. there's a win-win. Thank you for that. I will follow up on that. We're coming up to the top of the hour. I know Councillor Herrera will need to jump. Councillor Kohler.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I just thought maybe it would be important to get Chief Teague's perspective on his looking at all this and seeing how it could help Kaiser, and if it's truly a valuable thing in his opinion to work with the officers.
Chief?
Yeah, thank you, Councilor. Thank you, Mayor. Councilor Starr sent me a direct message just a moment ago asking, what's the percentage of calls for KPD responding to mental health issues? You know, that used to be almost a pretty steady number. I bet three, maybe five, but I'm more inclined to say like 3 years ago, it was almost a manageable number. But it has become, it has shot through the roof recently. And Anne-Marie mentioned this. Methamphetamine. This new methamphetamine, P2P meth, it'll flip you over into psychosis pretty quickly. And our, the number of times we deal with crazy people and EDPs, it's almost, it's becoming unmanageable. Unmanageable to the point, I think the culture is coming, becoming somewhat complacent about it. It's becoming so commonplace, which is a really bad place for us to be in our culture. So to answer your question, Councillor Kohler, yeah, it's important that we have all the tools we have to deal with this, especially because most of these are non-criminal matters, and yet we're the first responders. Still requires resources, and we still have to deal with the crime, which is also increasing. There isn't an easy answer to what Kaiser can do. I will reiterate something that Andrew Copeland said in the chat box, that it's a phenomenal program that we use almost every day. And Anne-Marie, we're grateful for it. Even if we're not players, we're grateful.
You guys have always been great partners, and we appreciate you too.
Thank you. That was very, very helpful. And I think we're going to see opportunities to talk about additional partnerships to broaden the number of people who know what to do and who to call in the event of a emotionally disturbed event. But the bigger thing Chief mentioned, and we are seeing this more and more as we have the discussion in the Homeless Alliance, is that P2P meth. And Chief sounded the alarm 2 years ago. And I've been paying very close attention to that because of it. And indeed, this is going to take a lot of the programs that we know work under non-P2P situations and turns them on their head. And we are not ready for that as a state. So this is going to be another opportunity. The more information we have to lean into our legislators going, we've got a problem. We've got a serious problem. A humanitarian crisis with the P2P meth. So any data that you get, Ryan, Anne-Marie, Anne, and Debbie, that would be very helpful for us to know about so we can lean in with our legislators going, this is the numbers, folks. This is the humanitarian crisis we are dealing with, and it's affecting across the board. Families, children, social services, emergency room, law enforcement, on and on, our neighborhoods. Any other questions or comments? Okay, I'm not seeing any hands raised, and we've just passed the top of the hour, but with that, I would love to thank you for coming on and sharing what you are doing. And we'll be able to share this video with people in our community so they can learn more about the work that Marion County is working to provide and expand the provision of these services in our community. So thank you
for the opportunity to be here. We really appreciate that.
Yes, thank you so much.
Well, please feel free to come back. Keep us updated. We do public testimony, but if you want to have an update for us, that we need to hear about, we can always make time at the beginning of a council meeting to bring you on 5-10 minutes, whatever is going to be helpful to continue to get the word out into our community about how we are doing and how we can constructively engage and support our mental health services here in Marion County. All right. Is there anything else that we need to cover tonight? All right, seeing none. Thanks again so much. We really appreciate it. And the time is 7:04, and we will be adjourned. Thank you so much.